By the way, I never received any answer from Rome on the presentation of the spiritual bouquet, which was 2.5 million rosaries. They never answered. The only answer is maybe in the motu proprio, where it is spoken that it is the fruit of many prayers. And Cardinal Castrillon told me that he was convinced that it was the fruit of our prayer if the motu proprio had come out with so few oppositions. It was an enormous opposition, but nevertheless they counted it as a little opposition. Okay. So we come to this motu proprio. How do we have to judge it? Once again, it is happening in the middle of a very large pressure and opposition. The German bishops, when in fact we have four bishop conferences, who will write to the Pope saying, we don't want that motu proprio. Just like that. It's the German, the French, the English, and in part the American bishops. So, the German, they came to see Cardinal Rinzi, and they told him, we don't want that motu proprio. And Cardinal Rinzi said, and me neither. He grabbed a new missal, and he showed it to the bishops. This is our baby. He's a traitor to the Pope. But it shows you what kind of a position the Pope can have just when he makes this motu proprio. If you look at the whole situation of the Church, this whole crisis, and we see that when only on one point he has so many problems, you have to understand that even if he would have the best intentions and the best understanding, nevertheless, he would be in a tremendous difficulty to make things better. I say even if, because so we have on one hand the motu proprio, but it's not everything. It's an important step. What is important in this motu proprio? What makes us say that it is a good thing for the Church, despite the fact that there are many things in it which we disagree with, of course, is this little phrase, it is said there, the Mass of the Blessed John the 23rd, but John the 23rd did not make a Mass. He just made some corrections in the rubrics and wrote in the name of Saint Joseph in the canon. That's all he did. And nevertheless, and so this Tridentine Mass, he says there, has never been abrogated. This is the essential of this motu proprio. Because saying this Mass has not been abrogated is changing at the level of the rite the status of the Mass. In fact, it's only stating that the Mass is still a universal law of the Church. If a law has not been abrogated, it means it remained what it was. And before, it was the Mass of the Church. To say this Mass has not been abrogated means it remains. It remains the Mass of the Church. And this little statement has, of course, enormous conclusions to be drawn. They are not drawn, or most of them are not drawn, in the paper. So you have to draw them by yourself. But they are at the level of the rite, the level of the law. And it's very important, even though, I may say, at the practical level, you may not see much of it. The first point, which is very interesting, is that the Pope says that the fact that the new Mass has been made and promulgated as a universal law in the Church. Usually, when you make a law which deals with a whole matter which was under a previous law, this new law is suppressing the old one. Well, Julius Caesar had decided that everybody would drive on the left. Napoleon took this driving card and changed it and said, no, we drive on the right. I think it was not very difficult to understand that when this new law was passed, the previous law was suspended, suppressed, well, no longer in vigor. You have a law in the Church which says Tridentine Mass. You have a new law which says the new Mass. It's like a law which says you drive on the left and the law which says you drive on the right. To say that the old law has not been abrogated is bringing about the same mess than saying you can drive either left or right. And I may say, you may find there the explanation of why in the first part of the motu proprio they try to deal with this problem. Of course, they deal very awkwardly, but they will say, well, in fact, there is only one Mass. But there are two forms, one ordinary, one extraordinary. If we go back to the traffic, you would say, okay, ordinary, you drive on the left or the right, whatever, one of them, and on an extraordinary way, you drive on the other side. Something like that. Well, we cannot agree with that, of course. We cannot agree that they will say that these two masses are only one Mass. It's not true. I may say it goes against the evidence. Anybody who sees both Masses understand very well that they are not the same. That they are not, let's say, two expressions of the same form. It's not true. But I may say it was, or we can understand that they try to find a trick to explain this new situation. Now this situation of the motu proprio, as I say, changes radically the status of the old Mass in comparison with the indult. When you say indult, you say exception, you say privilege, it is a law for a few. And when you have such a thing, you have conditions. You have maybe permission to ask. When you have a universal law, you don't have that. It's like the green light. Even if there is a policeman, when the light is green, you don't raise your hand and say, may I go? It's green. You go. When the Pope says, this Mass has not been abrogated, he says green light to the Tridentine Mass. And once again, that's a question of right. Then you have another question, which is also complicated, difficult, and it is then the concrete situation, the application of the law. How is this law applied? And there you see that the bishops, in a great, great generality, they want to deal with this motu proprio as with the indult. They want to have their word to say, you need my permission. It's strictly against the law. It's against the motu proprio, says the contrary. But it's the general attitude of most of the bishops. You have some exceptions, it is true, but the general attitude is that the bishops, they want and they put pressure on the priest to avoid a free diffusion of the Tridentine Mass, which is very important. I may say so. If real equality of right would be in practice given to the two Masses after a not too long time, the new Mass would disappear. Not too long time, you may relativize this. In Rome, I spoke with a high prelate who said one generation. Personally, I think probably a little bit more. So it's not a very short time. But let's say, if you look at the whole history of the Church, it's not too long. But once again, this is subject to one condition, and that is that real equality of right, as foreseen in the motu proprio, is really granted in the praxis. And once again, the bishop, they don't want that. In a certain way, you see that the modernists, they know that if you really give this freedom, it's done with the new Mass. For me, once again, only at the level of the law, legally speaking, this motu proprio is the declaration of death of the new Mass. But the problem is that there are too many who want it alive, and we try to oppose this motu proprio, and we try to continue to impose the hegemony of the new Mass against the old. So now we come to a very, I may say, decisive point in this history of the Church and the crisis. That is, on one hand, you have the Pope who has given a law, who has repeated the law. You have the bishops who oppose it. And now you have this confrontation. What is going to happen? If the Pope, as it appears, thinks that he is obliged to do that in conscience, he's opposing the bishops. But there is a new principle since Vatican II, which is called collegiality, which means the bishop, they have their say. And the majority of the bishops who say something, the Pope has to go with it. So now, if the Pope sticks to his conscience and his duty as Pope, he's going to put a blow against collegiality. And if he does not, that is, if he follows the bishops, then he gives up his power as Pope. Because the bishops will know it's just enough to put enough pressure on the Pope, and he gives up. So, as I say, we are in a decisive point, not, let's say, about the Mass first, but not only about the Mass, about the whole crisis, because if the Mass comes back, the Mass will not come back alone. It will come back with the faith, and finally with the moral. We see it with the priests who come back. It's striking. We have really tremendous experiences. Well, you may also make them, but these priests, after 2, 3, 5 times celebrating the old Mass, for them it's clear, it's two worlds, and they have to choose. You have some, you will find some who will go with both. Those who are serious, they are really put in a problem of conscience. And most of them make the right choice. Some of them don't, but most of them do. And that means that with the time, they will come back. They will come back to the Mass. And it's not only the Mass, because they understand all this world which is with it. Maybe they understand also that they need to learn, because they need to be to have a whole formation. Let's say the work in front of us is tremendous. It's enormous. It's not simple. These poor priests, they arrive with nothing. They discover a new world. Well, to go with it is not happening in one day. They need a formation. They need help, not only to celebrate correctly, but also to get with the theology which is with it, which is, let's say, the Catholic theology. We have already, as I say, a lot of witnesses, of testimonies, of priests who tell this to us. Priests who tell me, by celebrating the Tridentine Mass, I have discovered who is the priest. Of course, they had an idea of what is the priest. But with this Mass, sunk into the sacrifice of our Lord, they suddenly realize that they are put between God and man, and it goes about the salvation of souls, and not about circus, and I don't know what kind of Mass they have now. In Switzerland, they have carnival masses. They bring in all the people. They have even, well, they have special bands for the carnival, and one of the tricks is to play false. You recognize the melody, but expressly they play with wrong tones. And now these people come into the church and play during Mass. Carnival masses. That's what we have in Switzerland. Just to give you an example, well, of these new things, they do anything, any kind of thing. Of course, someone who has understood what is the Mass can no longer go with that. It's finished. And we have just now a very interesting history in Italy. In northern Italy, we have, two things. One is, there is a society of priests, 300 priests who join the tradition as a group. They have with them sisters also, and these sisters also, it's over 300 sisters, contemplative sisters, and they also come to tradition. So let's say that's good news. But it's only one. We have all the others to win, all the other congregations. But in the northern Italy, you have a certain number of priests, good 20 priests, but amongst them three parish priests in one diocese, who since the motu proprio have declared to the bishop, from now on it's only the Tridentine Mass. And what is interesting is that they have a whole development. It's just 2-3 years that they are, let's say, working with it. But now they have done it. And what is interesting, it's making a big fight between the bishop and so on. It has gone to Rome. And in the most important parish, which has over 1,000 souls, 800 of these faithful have written to Rome asking for the Tridentine Mass. It means that in a few months, this parish priest, who has made themselves this progress, this development, have also brought with them the faithful. Which shows it's not a new utopia. It can easily be a reality that in a certain number of years, really, the church could be brought back to the old. It takes a lot of energy, not a fight, but it's really possible. And I may say, this motu proprio is a great help for that. And for this, yes, we do, they say, thank the Pope. We have to be grateful for that. It was a very important act. Once again, not everything is perfect in it, plans again. There are many things we don't accept, like, for example, the holiness of the new Mass. It's crazy, but anyway, well, it's one point which is mentioned in this new motu proprio. But fundamentally, really, the face of this modern church could be changed, provided this motu proprio is really applied. In fact, one top guy in Rome told me, we could not suppress the new Mass in one shot. We have to go through several steps. Now, he did not say I, he said we. Is the Pope involved in this we? I don't know. I wish I would be able to give you an answer. I don't know. But anyway, there is a motu proprio, and there is someone pretty high who tells us that the final aim is the suppression of the new Mass. It's interesting. It's to be noted. Once again, it's one voice. We see a majority, tremendous majority of bishops, of priests who oppose this. So we have to be aware of these two realities. It's a mixture, I know. I wish that we would be able to simplify things for you, but no, I think it's, we have to be fair and to have a correct look of things. There are happy things and at the same time bad things happening at the same time. The problem is even worse when it's the same Pope who has two sides. And as I showed you with this prayer on the Jews, about the Jews, he made it, and okay, we speak of pressure, there is certainly a pressure, but I don't know what's the problem there, but he feels an obligation towards the Jews. He's constantly doing favors to them which are difficult to understand. What's really behind? There's a mystery there. There's something curious, strange. But anyway, and I may say that's not the worst. The worst is his theology. And this theology, he's also bringing something new there, and I think it's important for us to understand that element too. And this time it deals with the council and with the reforms. It's very tricky. Till now, it was a common understanding in the Church that Vatican II is something new, that there is a more or less radical change in the Church with Vatican II. And even you have several seminaries where the priests, the new priests, the seminarians, they learn about the Church only with, let's say, they have as sources only since Vatican II and on, and nothing before. In many seminaries, they don't learn anything of what happened before Vatican II. It's a striking reality. Really, Vatican II, it's the start. They have no knowledge of what was before. And many seminaries. Do you have now a Pope who says, no, it can't be. There must be a link. There cannot be a rupture between before and after the council. And this link must be tradition. He told me during the audience, the only acceptable interpretation of the council is according to the criterion, or if you want, according to the light of tradition. Well, no, don't. Wait a minute. The problem, and there is a big problem here, I will illustrate it by a little story. In 82-83, Archbishop Lefebvre wrote to the Pope saying, "You have said somewhere that the Council had to be seen in the light of tradition. We accept the Council in the light of tradition. And here is what it means. What in the Council does or is in harmony with tradition, we accept. What is doubtful in the Council, we read it according to the understanding of what we have in the past, so according to tradition. And what is opposed, we reject." And Cardinal Ratzinger answered this letter. And he said, "Your proposal about the Council, though very short, could be acceptable. That is, the Council in the light of tradition. But what you say afterwards is unacceptable." So to say that we reject what is opposed to the Council, this is to the tradition, this is unacceptable. And now, in fact, they don't say in the light of tradition, they say in the light of living tradition. Everything is in this word, living. And in fact, when we say tradition, we don't say the same as they say. And in 88, when Archbishop Lefebvre is condemned, he's excommunicated in the very text, the motu proprio Ecclesia Dei Afflicta, which condemns Archbishop Lefebvre and the newly consecrated bishops. The text explains that Archbishop Lefebvre has a wrong understanding of tradition. He has an incomplete idea of tradition. Here we are. We use the same word. It does not have the same meaning. When we say tradition, we just repeat this definition of tradition given by the father of the Church, Saint Vincent de Lérins, who said, "Quod ubique, quod semper, quod ab omnibus," what has been believed by all, everywhere, and in all times. What has been believed? It is an object. When we say tradition, we mean the doctrine. We mean the discipline of the Church. It's something what has been entrusted by our Lord to the apostles, which they have to transmit to the next generation. Transmit means tradere, traditio, transmission. So the tradition means what is transmitted, the object. For the modern, tradition is an act. It is the act of transmitting. It is a way to understand tradition, yes. And when you speak of tradition, you can use that sense. It's possible. It's not the most usual, but you can. The act of transmitting. But now when you speak of the act of transmitting, you look at the person who transmits. And you no longer look at what is transmitted. And the person who transmits, that's the Pope. That's, let's say, the Church, the teaching Church, the bishops with the Pope. And that's living tradition. Because that's an act, that's to say alive. Till then, no problem. The problem comes now with the word living. Because, that's the trick, living means movement, and movement means change. There are certain changes which are legitimate, others which are not. Very simple. You have a tree home. I hope for you that this tree is alive, because if not, it's dead. So if you have a living tree, it does not move, not mean that your tree is going to move from one side of your garden to another, or maybe on the road, or maybe further. No. It does not even mean that one year he's going to produce oranges, and next year, because he's alive, apples. The life of the tree means that every year he's going to produce the same fruits. The transmission of the tree will be, thanks to its life, that he will bring always the same fruits. He's not going to change. That's the trick. They use the word living to mean change where there cannot be change. And it's obvious in the present Pope that on one side, he does condemn those who say Vatican II must be a rupture with the past. So he's condemning, let's call them the extremists, the supermodernists who want a new church. The present Pope is much more subtle. He say, no, it must be the same church, it must be the same faith, because the faith cannot change. At the same time, he will accept the changes. And he will say, these changes are traditional. Now it's weird. Yes, it is. And even terribly weird. In his talk to the Curia of the 22nd of December 2005, it's one of the most important texts of the present pontificate. And if you want to understand the vision of the Holy Father, Benedict XVI, on the Church, you just read that document. It is fairly clear, fairly simple text. In this text, he is explaining why the Council had to bring in novelties, which are supposedly not new. It's a little problem there, but he's explaining that these novelties, they deal with the relation of the Church with the world. And he explains that in the 19th century, the world was very bad and very mean. And that's why the Church has to defend herself and to be also very bad and mean against the world. The word he uses is radical. The Church was radical against the world. And then he explained that during the 20th century, well, this world has become much nicer. And that's why you have a Vatican II, where the Church has to adapt again to this new position of the world. So the world being nicer, the Church has also to be nicer. And he will use four times in this talk a sentence. It was necessary for the Church to give a new definition of the relation between, and then four times we'll have something, between the Church and modern state, between the Church and the other religions, between the Church and Judaism, between the Catholic faith and modern science. That every time it was necessary to give a new definition of the relation between. So, a new relation, how's that? And he will explain, he will develop expressly the question of the relation between the Church and the state. And he will explain that the modern state does want to have the type of relation with all religions. He will deal with all religions more or less impartially give the same rights to all religions. And he says, by adopting one of the fundamental principles of the modern state, which is religious liberty, the Catholic Church has rediscovered or recovered its patrimony. Now it is in syntony with the teaching of Jesus Christ. If you reflect a little bit of what it means that so that during 1,500, 1,600, 1,700 years, the Church had lost its patrimony and was not in harmony with the teaching of our Lord. It's unbelievable what he says there. But that's what he says. There you can realize that there is a problem, and a big problem. We deal with things which are very, very close to the faith. When you deal with the relation between the Church and the state, why do we say that there must be a relation between the Church and the state? Because all the members of the Church do also belong to a state. And because these people, that is us, all of us, being in one state or another, we have to make our salvation in this world. And if the state does recognize the laws of God, he will make laws which are in harmony with the commandments of God. And with this, it will tremendously help the people in the state, in their common life, to lead a life which is in harmony with God's commandments, and by this to save their soul. And if the state declares, I treat every religion the same way, the state does not feel bound by any of God's commandments, and he does his own laws. That means that the faithful members of these states are no longer helped by the state to do the salvation. And we know it does not necessary to reflect a lot to understand that the civil society, the society in which we live, just because it is a society, because it is an organism, has puts pressure on its members. For those who go in the flow, there is no pressure. Precisely, those who go counter-current, there is a pressure from the group. Now, if this pressure is for the good, fine. If it is for the bad, for the evil, that's very serious. And in the modern state, we can see now, with all these laws that are passed, which goes against natural law, they are turning this society in earth as a hell. This life on earth becomes more and more hell-like. Because they don't care about God's law. And that's why it's so important to insist that the state also has to recognize God as creator and as divine providence. And as a lawgiver, it's so clear. And the Church has always taught that. And now you have the Pope who says that by breaking that law, the Church is in harmony with the teaching of our Lord Jesus Christ. Oh, it's terrible. But you see, it's not the only example. I will give you one or two, and then coming to the end. It's a new vision, a new way of explanation, the changes of the council. Till now, they didn't care about justifying. They just say, it's something new, let's go. Now you have a Pope who is more careful about the past. We say, no, you cannot break with the past. You must be linked with the past. This part, this sentence is all right, it's good. Yes, it's true, we must be linked with the past. But when it becomes tricky, is that nevertheless, he wants the new things. And in order to keep both, we say it's impossible to have both. It's either or. But he wants to, so to say, to give an aspergesme on these novelties. He wants to bless these novelties and he wants to baptize them as traditional. We say it's against all the tradition and he says, no, it's traditional. You see, that's now the problem where we are entering in. And it makes it very delicate. Before it was clear, it was a yes and it was a no. Now it's a yo. Another example, just 1 week after publishing this motu proprio, there is another text which comes from Rome, this time from the Congregation of the Doctrines of the Faith. And it is a note for a better understanding of the definition of the Church. Now this text is explaining us that at the time of the Council there was a change in the definition of the Church. I go back to Casper. You know Casper? I like him because he's very clear. In one of his conferences on the fundament of ecumenism, Cardinal Casper explains that the normal definition of the Church given throughout the times by the Church is the Church of Christ is the Catholic Church. So this is, this word is, makes the identity. Now, this word is really different from all the others. Because to say the identity means to glue together the subject and the object of the proposition. If you say the Church of Christ is the Catholic Church, you can reverse the proposition. The Catholic Church is the Church of Christ. Because they are one. This word is like a kind of glue and it provokes or expresses this identity. Now it's the only word we have which does that. If you use any kind of other word, you will have a subject and you will have an object. The verb in between will make a link between both, but they will remain distinct. And Cardinal Casper explains that until Pius XII, in his encyclica on the Church, Mystici Corporis, the Church gives the definition is. Excuse me. The Council changes it. The Council will say the Church of Christ subsists in the Catholic Church. You very well understand that this is different from that. When you say this subsists in this, you have two. Well, one is subsisting in the other, okay, but you have two. And Casper explains that this word subsists is a fundament of ecumenism for the Catholic Church. He goes so far as to say that it is this change which made the ecumenism possible for the Catholic Church. It's clear. That means that as long as the Church, the Catholic Church says the Church of Christ is the Catholic Church, ecumenism is impossible. Just like that. And it's the cardinal who who is the head of ecumenism who says it. So it's not just someone. He's somebody who has the understanding of these things. Now, this note for a better understanding of the definition of the Church, tells us first that this word subsist has received a certain number of interpretations, and there are some errors, so we need now to correct the errors. And they say, well, the Church does not want, with Vatican II, to change the faith. We want to keep the same faith. We don't want to change. Oh, interesting. The Church believes and continues to believe what it believed before. So the text is going to explain that, yes, we said is before. And it says, and we are bound with this. We cannot change it. So they ask in the text itself, so why did we change? And they will say, subsists expresses the identity more perfectly than is. And it continues by explaining the real reason of this subsist. In fact, they have changed it because they wanted to say that there is something of the Church of Christ outside of the Catholic Church. That's the problem. And so here they say this word subsist says better than is, and something else. If we are logic, if we apply this question of the definition with a consequence, which is the salvation. You know that there is a dogma which says, outside of the Church, there is no salvation. Now, if you say, is, the Church of Christ is the Catholic Church, you clearly say, when you say, outside of the Church, there is no salvation, outside of the Catholic Church, there is no salvation. And if you follow the text, which says, well, subsist means is, you say, you have it. Now, what about the second part? Because they say there is another part. They say there are elements, those who have left the Church, they have run away with some certain parts of the Church, like the sacraments, certain sacraments. Well, this is true. It was a theft, but it is true. Now, what is interesting is that they are going to say that these elements outside of the Church, they continue to work. That's what they say. Clearly said, or more clearly said, that means they save. And that means outside of the Church, there is salvation, which is the contrary to the dogma. Outside of the Church, there is no salvation. And it is in order to have or to link this contradiction that you have this note which will say both at the same time. I tried to read it, I don't know how many times, let's say 5-10 times this text, try to get to the point, what do they really want to say? But you come to nothing. Because they will explain you that where you have true bishops and a true Mass, the Church of Christ is present. Well, they speak of the Orthodox, of the Oriental churches outside of the Church. They say they have real bishops, they have a real Mass, so the Church of Christ is present. They will continue by saying, and these are true, authentic, particular churches. Now we speak of particular in opposition to universal when you speak of a diocese. A diocese is a particular church of the whole Catholic Church. Now if you say that these people outside of the Church are also genuine particular churches, then what's the difference between the diocese inside and these things outside? They will even say that the Church of Christ is edified and brought to perfection in these particular churches outside of the church.